So as you know already, my name is Nelson Abreu, and I'm one of the members of the ICRL consortium and one of the contributing authors of Filters and Reflections, our anthology that focuses on different perspectives on how we perceive reality differently, so quite appropriately. And if you're familiar with the publication, you will know that some chapters were on biology, others on particular branches of philosophy, and my own was on the out-of-body experience and allied phenomena. And in today's talk, I don't intend to repeat much of what is in the chapter, and I understand many of you have an interest in the practical side and also on how the out-of-body experience affects the whole question of survivability of consciousness after death, right, the so-called theta phenomenon. So I'll be focusing on those aspects, and as I go, feel free to type questions, comments, and as we go along. So I hope everyone can hear me well right now, and very well. So let's get started. So a little bit about myself for those of you who haven't done the last webinar or haven't met me before. I was born in Portugal. My ancestry from India, in case you can't tell. And really, one of the things about the out-of-body experience is that it makes many of these things pretty irrelevant. Gender, I mean, even age takes a whole new meaning. So it's a little bit irrelevant, but just out of a curiosity. And I've been in the States since high school. And it was in high school that I first came across this subject of out-of-body experience. Prior to that, I had not really had any experiences that I can recall, at least. Unlike many other people who are interested in this subject, who maybe at the year age of 9 or 4, started having experiences, that wasn't really my case. I actually first learned about it by chatting with some Brazilian friends who had some other friends who were studying the topic, and I read about it, and it just seemed fascinating. And one of the things that really impressed me was the idea that I could spend my whole life reading about it, attending lectures, and just believing or not believing things. And one of the things that really attracted me was this concept that if I managed to have my own experience, going out of the body, having this astral travel, as they sometimes call it, or projection of the consciousness, and while in this projected state, if I was able to see something remotely, meaning at a distance, similar to PAIR's remote viewing studies, if I was able to go out of the body, go to another locale, see something at a distance, and then confirm it, that would be tremendous. Or what if I could go out of the body, meet someone who's passed away, obtain some information from them that I don't know and that really very few people know, and then relate this back to their survivors? What would that be like? What about going out of the body and then a good friend of mine or a girlfriend or someone else can also go out of the body? What would that be like? So these were the things that excited me most. The idea that it is a tool that once proven out through experience could be a reliable source of information about what happens beyond the physical level, the physical senses, beyond the physical filters, if you will, and give us a glimpse from a totally different, higher perspective. It kind of reminds me of this novel or fable about Flatland, Flat World. I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. I don't know if any of you have never heard of it, but there's also actually a YouTube video with Carl Sagan discussing this fable. He was very fond of it. And the interesting thing about this story is that you have a world that is flat. Hence, everything in it is either a line or a square, something two-dimensional as well. and they have no idea what three dimensions means. The concept hasn't even occurred to them, right? And imagine what would happen if an object, a three-dimensional object, came out of nowhere and started crossing this two-dimensional world. First, it would be maybe they would see the point. Something would appear, and then something bigger and bigger as the cross-section goes through, and they would start getting smaller, smaller, and they would disappear out of thin air. And they would say, oh my gosh, that's some sort of paranormal thing. You know, it's, or if whoever talked about it, probably they would say, are you crazy? What are you talking about? Stuff showing up out of nowhere and disappearing? You're insane, you know? Or they would say, he's a genius, he's a seer, he's a very special person, right? But in fact, it was something very normal, nothing paranormal about it, just something that they don't understand. And maybe this person thinks that they were some sort of monster. And this three-dimensional object gets a little upset. You know, I'm no monster, just a three-dimensional object. So let me show you what that means. And imagine that they would pick up the square, right, off the flat world and turn them. And now they're looking in at their world from the third dimension, from above. And all of a sudden, all kinds of things that seem weird and unexplainable all make sense or make more sense. And now they have new questions. And now imagine this square comes back and tries to explain what just happened. So out-of-body experience can feel a little bit like that, you know, in the sense that you go out, you look back and say, oh, okay, energies. I can see energies. I know what that means now when they talk about chakras and they talk about things like that. Spirits and apparitions and ghosts. And, okay, there's nothing out of this world. It's, you know, out of the physical paradigm. But you realize, hey, this is a multidimensional world. And you have the physical world, and you have also these other levels that you can access. And you don't have to wait till you die to figure that out. You can. You also don't have to have a car wreck or electric shock and get a near-death experience, right? It's basically, the near-death experience is basically an out-of-body experience caused by a severe condition, a trauma, right? And those are very impactful, right? People who have near-death experiences, they change a lot. So I got into this because it seemed exciting. It seemed very interesting that I could have my own experiences. I didn't have to rely on what some guy on Sundays was telling me to be the truth, or what I read in a book, right? What some special person was trying to tell me. I, just some regular guy, I can actually have my own experiences and reach my own conclusions. And so can anyone else who is willing and interested and courageous enough to face those fears that come from the unknown and realize things that were mystified, mystical in the sense of unexplainable, right? Not in the sense of spiritual, that really those things can be attainable. So that's how I got into it. And I was also interested later on. What sustained my interest was this impact that it has in people's lives. So what happens when you realize through a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience in general, or really a series of out-of-body experiences, what happens when you realize that there is no death, there is no birth of the consciousness, just the body, and that you can actually go out of the body and see that there are people preparing for this life, meaning they pre-exist this life. You could see them maybe even in childlike form, getting acquainted with what physical life is like, thinking about their life mission and what they're going to do, and sort of non-physical universities and training centers, auditoriums full of people planning and learning. So it's very, very interesting to be able to witness this and then to see that other people also are witnessing similar things, and you can compare notes and start reaching a sort of consensus. It's like going to a foreign land, coming back with reports, and then reading other people's reports, and pretty soon you start realizing we must be going to the same place, seeing the same things. Or you go together, more than two people going out of the body and seeing the same things, the same realms. One of the things that comes out of this then is the loss of fear of death. So you lose the fear of death because you realize people who passed on, you can still meet them. People who are born, they're pre-existing. And this is one phase. And the phase before and after is just another phase. So this comes not from belief, but from actual experience. And that is a very powerful difference. You notice people in general believe in an afterlife of some sort, but they're really terrified of death. And they make silly decisions based on that many times. They don't act like they are immortal consciousness. They usually act like they're a material being because they're trying to avoid thinking of the spiritual, because it just reminds them of the fact they're going to die and they don't know what's after. Yet, once they overcome this fear of death, they actually can live more fully. They actually start thinking, okay, if I could live in this afterlife, in this extra physical world, without having to pay bills, for example, without having to sleep, and a number of other physical things, then why not just be in that level forever? What's the point of physical life? So you start thinking about life mission and life purpose and relationships and how you can address those and so on. So loss of fear of death is a big one. And it integrates well into studying the other phenomena because essentially it gives you a different perspective to study clairvoyance, to understand remote viewing, to understand psychic phenomena like poltergeist, right? So for example, if you ask, if you asked our dear friend Bill Roll, when I met with him in those scientific exploration meetings, right? He would say, I've had one of those experiences, you know, he had one. And he questioned the whole experience because the shadow of some sort of furniture was cast in a different way. So he said, oh, it can't be true. It can't be real. Right, so he just ascribed some expectations to the experience that may or may not, you know, be reasonable. But it's interesting that unless you have many experiences or some impactful ones, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are, or even if you have one single experience, you might still essentially maintain the physical materialistic paradigm. Other very intelligent people like Faraday, and they have had this sort of experience in those tanks with those flotation tanks and so on. So the paradigm can be very, very strong to overcome. But if you have enough of these experiences, the evidence just is so impressive that you cannot lie to yourself for so long, right? So I'll give you an example then with this poltergeist. So from the perspective of Dr. Roll and others, this phenomenon was caused by a physical individual, usually a young girl, adolescent, or younger, and that this type of activity was actually generated by that physical consciousness, and that they were acting essentially in a semi-conscious way, right? So they call this theory supersci. So according to supersci theory, then it's the physical people that created. There are no ghosts per se, right, that are causing the phenomena. It's people unconsciously causing objects to move and so on. So in essence, with out-of-body experience, you can actually perceive that the child, in this case, is acting as a battery, providing the physical energy for it. But it is typically extra-physical, and people without a physical body, let's say, or in between lives, that are generating the phenomenon. But how could you know that? How could you know that without going out of the body? You can't. So I never blame Dr. Roll for saying that it was the physical person. That is the logical conclusion that you would reach according to Occam's razor, right? Principle. You say, okay, what's the simplest explanation for this? The physical individual is causing it. But if you were out of the body during that moment, you would realize that the physical person contributing to it with the energy, and that's why the phenomena follow it many times wherever they go. But it is not the whole picture. But how can you see the picture without going there? You can't. So it's a bit of a catch-22 for people who are not interested in really knowing, because you know they don't know because they don't have the experience. They have the experience because they don't care to have one. So there is really a lost cause. So I don't waste much of my time trying to convince people and really convincing is really not something that should interest any of us as a scientific movement, right, on consciousness. It's really about evidence. And so I am more than glad to engage with people and teach them techniques and other things if they're really willing to experience it. Because what I found is that whether you're someone who's had experiences since 4 years old or someone like me that had no experiences, at least that I can recall, and had to essentially start training and little by little having more and more experiences, more interesting ones, it's really at everyone's reach, right? So some of you had asked about the practical side, you know, the how to. Of course, it's very difficult in a short webinar, right, to teach about how to go out of the body and some of the preparation that goes into, right? I just stepped out of a course. That's why I arrived just in time for the webinar, teaching that, and that was a 40-hour thing, you know. So, but in general, I would say it starts, first of all, with just thinking about the out-of-body experience. Sometimes someone just reads a book about it with experiences, like a Robert Monroe book or Dr. Walter Vieira book or William Bowman or any of these guys, and they read their experiences and they think, wow, that's so cool. And they go to sleep thinking about it. And next thing you know, they're out of the body. They're looking back at their body. They don't really know how it happened. It was spontaneous. And then they decide to go through the wall and float. And or maybe they think of a friend. And when they arrive at the person's house, just by thinking of them, they realize that they had a pot of flowers with specific colors. And they had a book. And they can tell what's the title of the book, or there's a guest and they can describe what they were wearing and so on. And then they call them up and say, I just had this experience. It was very vivid, as if I was really there, but not with the physical body, but with some other more subtle body. And this is what I saw. Is that what happened? And they'll tell, yeah, that's exactly what happened. How could you have known? And that's weird because, you know, this friend never wears shorts, but that day they were wearing shorts and they were, you know, brown and so on. And how did you know they were even there? So that's a very common everyday experience. The thing is that most people, even though they do have the experience, let's say at least 10, 20% of people have had one of these, according to most surveys, they don't go to the office around the water cooler and say, hey, you know what happened last night? I had this cool experience. Why? Because they're afraid of how they will be perceived. Sometimes they won't even tell their own partner, you know, in their life partner, husband, wife, girlfriend, because they're afraid to be judged. At least that's the case here, you know, out west. So how do you think that OBEs can be validated at all? Thank you, Vasileus, for this good question. First of all, I have to go back to the whole skepticism idea, and I think it's extremely valid and valuable to do this validation research, okay? As we know from Per's work, 30 years of validation and actual measurable data, we're not talking about extra-physical things here, we're talking about statistically valid, measurable things in one in a trillion odds, and that's not good enough for some people. So, you know, I'm not talking about validation for those kinds of people, but for the person who wants to know, okay, am I crazy? Is this fantasy that just feels real, or is it really real? That is different, right? So for your own sake, right, as a person who's neutral, right, that you just want to know what's going on, are you fooling yourself, or is this real? Then I already gave some examples, right? So for example, you go out of the body and you verify, you witness something at a distance, and then you can pretty much figure the odds of just guessing it, right, or having that same kind of experience. Not unlike, if you talk about more controlled study, what was done with remote viewing studies at PAIR, The only difference is instead of using remote viewing, whereby the person is still in their physical body and their perception travels somewhere, almost like their eyes are somewhere else, their body would be actually in sleep mode, if you will, and their perception would go, and not just their perception, but their entire being, their locus of being would go there. That's the main difference. There are a few other differences, like remote viewing, you tend to see a very limited area, but very sharply. Whereas with out-of-body experience, you have a global view of where you are. You can even see 360 degrees at the same time. But typically, it's a little fuzzy, not so focused unless you focus on a specific area. So that's the main difference. Many of you have probably heard of a gentleman called Ingo Swann. So Ingo Swann was an active researcher and participated in lots of experiments in the 60s, 70s. And essentially, he could do both. He was a good artist as well. So he could draw what he saw through remote viewing at a distance. But also, he was known to be able to go out of the body. But when he was out of the body, his body would be still. The body still is asleep, is in a deep vegetative sleep. But he was conscious somewhere else. But then it doesn't look like you're seeing something at a distance. You feel like you are at that place distantly, right? So you are basically traveling with another body. That's you could use it to see at a distance, but it feels different, right? So we classify it in a different way. So you could use those methods, the remote perception methods, to validate OBE. The other thing is for the everyday individual who doesn't have, an expert staff like the PAIR laboratory, they can use experiences of everyday life. Say they go out of the body, and they can even help maybe their spouse go out of the body as well by waking them up out of the body from their sleep. And then they can have an experience together, go somewhere specific, discuss things that they would be unlikely to guess later, and then come back. IAC has run some experiments of the sort, IAC being the International Academy of Consciousness, where I teach. They've run some experiments where hooked up to a database of about 250, 300 images, and then they would actually invite people from all over the world to come and see what that image was. The image would be picked from the database through a program that would run overnight when the door was locked. And people had a few hours to witness. And essentially, we realized that many people weren't able to do it. It was actually very difficult for them. But the ones who were able to do it, at least periodically, they could give either partial results, like give an idea of what it looks like, maybe describe the shape, but give it the wrong name, like a tall, narrow jar instead of a thermometer, or the image would be flipped, or the color brown. It has a red bow. The head is tilted slightly to the left, and it's standing on a shelf. That's too much detail, and it was absolutely correct. So let's say the noise in the signal can vary, right? And also the recollection process can be better or worse, depending on the individual, on their condition, on the specific day. But that's, I think, is the most powerful way to validate the OBE is how can two people or more observe the same thing, or how can you observe something at a distance? But I'd like to say another thing. If you are watching this webinar right now, let me ask you, how do you validate this? How do you validate this? Or in other words, how do you know you're actually, watching this webinar with me? How do you know you're not dreaming or having a nightmare, depending on how good the webinar is going? But, right, so how do you know? Well, you just know, right? Because this is as real as anything we've ever known, right? At least for most of us. So the out-of-body experience is not so different when it is a lucid, completely lucid, conscious experience. So when you're out of the body with the same or greater level of awareness that you have now, there isn't much doubt in your mind. So the validation is really for other people. They will say, how do you know, right, that you are not dreaming or just it's a very vivid imagination? But you know, because it's as vivid, as real feeling as this is. It's almost self-evident. It's reality, which comes from the fact that you are so conscious, so aware, and everything follows in a rational, logical progression, not like a dream where things change in a weird way or you have a different frame of mind because you're so unlucid, so unconscious, that an elephant could walk in and start talking to you, and you start discussing philosophy with it, you know, and then all of a sudden it turns into your auntie and you're talking to her and you don't think anything of it. But later you think, wow, that was bizarre. But with out-of-body experience, if something like that would happen, or now, right now, if I turned into a giraffe and kept talking, you'd say, something's wrong with this video, right? Feed, that is not normal. Why? Because you're conscious, you're aware, you have your rationality. Well, it's the same out of the body when you have a high lucidity experience. Now, if the experience is semi-lucid, it's a little, you're a little sleepy per se in that experience, right? You're not 100% aware, then it can be a little challenging to know what part is real, what part is not. If it's really an OB or a dream, it can get difficult. I'll give you that much. But if the experience is 100% lucid, there's really no doubt in your mind. I'll give you some examples from history. Like, I don't know if you've heard of Swedenborg, for example. So Swedenborg was a Swedish scientist. He was actually in the Swedish Academy of Sciences. So he's very well-reputed scientist in all of Europe, really, but especially in Sweden. And then he started having these experiences and documented them. One of the first major works on the topic called the Spiritual Diaries. And he described many things that happen in the afterlife, if you will, or in between lives, right? In the intermissive period, or as Jim Tucker calls it, the intermission. And he was even summoned by the queen at one point, and she asked him to look into her brother who had passed away and say, see if you can locate him, tell me how he's doing. And he said he would try, and supposedly he was able to do it and comes back to her and tells her he's fine, and he, you know, probably says something like he loves you, right, or something like that. But what he said that that stood out was, and just so you know that I really met him, I'm not just saying this so you feel good, he told me blank, right? So something that only the queen and the brother knew, is like some sort of secret between the two of them, so that there's no way he could have known that by any other means other than getting it from her or from him. So she was pretty impressed, let's put it that way, right? Then you have also the evidence coming from near-death experiences, right? That's very interesting, compelling stuff. For example, the experience of Pamela Reynolds. It was a very high-profile case because she was undergoing some sort of cryo surgery. It's a intrusive procedure whereby, you know, her skull is open, all of her blood is drained from her body. Her body's temperature is cooled to a very crisp temperature so that she can survive for 20, 30 minutes while they're doing the procedure without blood. And then she's slowly revived. So let me ask you this. So how can you hallucinate without blood flow in your brain? So if your brain is not working at all, it's literally frozen. How can you have any experience if the brain is the source of all experience? But if, as we have concluded, right, with the research at Pear and elsewhere, we can see that, it could be possible because the brain is more of a transducer for the consciousness to act, to manifest physically, but it doesn't create it. It is not emerging from the brain. It's being transmitted through the brain, rather. So this lady, the reason she was all over the news, it's because while she's undergoing this procedure, she had an out-of-body experience. She witnessed details, technical details of the procedure that she was not privy to in terms of medical knowledge. She's just a lay person. And she was able to describe things that were said, what people were doing. So luckily, the doctors didn't say anything nasty about her, right? But she also talks about meeting a relative, like an uncle, that comes to greet her and kind of remind her of things that she has to look forward to in life and responsibilities and goals, and then comes back to the body and feels like the body is a tub of ice, essentially, and little by little reincorporates. So this sounds like a near-death, out-of-body type experience. But what's interesting about it is, for the longest time, people were saying near-death experience is caused by lack of oxygen to the brain, or anoxia. Well, in this case, there was not a lack of oxygen. There was no oxygen. There's no blood flow. So you cannot even call it a hallucination, because you cannot even hallucinate if the brain's not working at all. It's on pause, if you will. So that was a very interesting case as well. So if you look between near-death experience evidence, out-of-body experience evidence of a remote location, I think you have your answer there. Any other questions, comments, things you'd like me to focus on? I could go on for hours here, but I might not cover what you're looking for. So while you think of the next question, I'll talk a little bit about the practical side, because there was an interest in that, and the how-to. So obviously, the physical relaxation is the first part. If you can stay still for long periods of time, that actually is good. The question is being able to do that while awake, right? So some people can stay awake, but they don't relax when they're trying to go out of the body. Other people relax really well, but they fall asleep. So how can you relax extremely well to the point where your body is very numb or torpid, as we say, meaning that you could move it, but it's so relaxed, like a damp a cloth, like a wet rag, that you don't want to move it. And also, you could get to the point where you can't move it even if you wanted to for a few seconds. The experience known as sleep paralysis, right? It's basically an experience related to the out-of-body experience. It happens many times as you go to sleep or as you wake up. And it's sort of like an in-between state between the physical state and out-of-body experience. So actually, it could be used as a window, as a launching point into out-of-body experience. So person is relaxed, deeply relaxed, and awake. The next point would be to study what actually happens, what connects us to the body, and what loosens up. It's what we call energy, even though that may not be the right word for it. Bioenergy, chi, prana, some sort of vital substance, right? And I have an image here. I don't know if you'll be able to see it, but here it is, a graph. And essentially shows a young lady having an astral projection, or out-of-body experience. So you can see the physical body is lying down, and then there's this subtle body that starts to disconnect. And then here it is, the energies with the silver cord and the astral body here now projected. So the interesting observation is then the mediating factor between out-of-body experience, the physical body, and the astral body or emotional body is this energy, this substance, this subtle matter or subtle energy that it's been talked about for ages. Right? People can feel it between their hands, right? If you concentrate between your palms for an extended period of time and try to accumulate some sort of substance here, just with your willpower, you can actually start to feel it. And it feels a little magnetic. It doesn't take very long to start to feel it. Some people see it around people's head or entire body, and they call it the aura, right? They talk about chakras and meridians and acupuncture and Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and, Africa, they call it Ashe, among other things. The Egyptians, they called it Ba. So everyone's talked about chakras and energy and out-of-body experience. It's nothing new. it's just our approach, the way we look at it, and making it less exclusive. You know, you don't have to be a priest, a shaman. The regular folk, right, can actually benefit from it. And it's less elitist, right, if you will. So we talked about physical relaxation as the first step. The second one then is also a sort of psychological relaxation, or just lack of anxiety, even though you may be motivated. But really, that energy then, what do we do about that energy? Because that energy can be like a glue. If it's so stuck, so unused, or it's so stagnant, crystallized, it actually becomes difficult to go out of the body, right? Even if you want to. So some people don't go out because they don't want to, right? It only happens maybe once in their life spontaneously when they didn't mean to. Other people want to, but they have a hard time because they have a huge blockage in a chakra, for example, or their overall, their whole energy body is not very vitalized, which also is not great for their health and their well-being in general. So one of the things we focus on is very much this energy. Some of you, many of you probably already felt the state called we call it vibrational state, but essentially it can also happen spontaneously, like the out-of-body experience. It feels like your whole body is in a vibratory resonant state. Again, that resonant topic that keeps coming up, propping up with our pair studies, right? So your entire energy system enters into a resonant state. And what happens is this actually pops out in a way, or separates, even if it's slightly, your astral body, your emotional body from the physical body. And it opens up the channel, the bandwidth, for psychical information. So if you want to do remote viewing, clairvoyance, out-of-body experience, any sort of psi phenomenon, we notice that triggering this vibrational state and this at least partial separation between the bodies increases your psi abilities, at least for those moments. And then overall, as you continue. So that's one of the things that, you know, we focused a lot of attention is, how can you actually trigger the state? How can you make this energy more fluid, less blocked? So as you improve in that department, you automatically improve in the out-of-body experience area. And what I've noticed is, since my high school days when I studied this with some friends, one of the guys that did the best was a Taiwanese friend of mine. He's in med school right now. And he essentially took him a couple of weeks only to have his first experience. Took me about 5 months to have a full-fledged out-of-body experience. But he did it pretty quick. And we were amused to see the changes in him. So he started having some psychical episodes. So, for example, his mother would trade stocks. And one day, he told his mother, just came to his mind, you need to sell Yahoo, like all of it, just sell it. And he said, you're a silly guy, you know, I'm the expert here. Everybody knows Yahoo is doing great. You're silly, go back to your studies, you know. And that day, Yahoo tanked big time. She lost a lot of money. And she was a little upset. So, but wondering also, how could he know? She would move some personal effect of his, and you would just be guided and kind of just find it in the weirdest places. Or he's sitting with some friends and he calls out 4 or 5 numbers of the lottery right before they come out in a row. And they're just amazed. Like, how did you just do that? But we know that if he probably tried to play, he wouldn't get it, right? It had to be that moment, that condition. So he started actually having more psychical abilities, more episodes or experiences, which goes to show there's no such thing really as the psychic, or the medium. We all have these potentialities. Some, no doubt, have more predisposition than others, like I just said. This friend of mine, it took him 2 weeks, took me 5 months, but the point is we're both able to do it. Same way, like a violin virtuoso could be 4 years old and put any 40-year-old to shame. But if the 4-year-old really wants to learn, they can learn too, right? That's the idea. So physical relaxation, improving the condition of our energy that negotiates the exchange of information and energy between the bodies. That's the other big thing. And then finally, it has a lot to do with your mental outlook. So if you are motivated, and if you apply also certain techniques that can facilitate the process, like certain breathing techniques, certain concentration techniques, or self-suggestion, there's a whole number of techniques that can be used and adapted to the needs or characteristics of the individual. You put all of this together, and you could have experiences within, like I said, a couple of weeks or just a few months. In my case, though, even though it took me a long time, I consider a long time, 5 months, to have my first full-fledged OB, from the first day I tried, I had some experience. I felt vibration. I felt different chakras activated. I felt a number of sensations. And also, what's very neat is the partial projection, where you only project, say, one arm or a leg or from the waist up. And that was one of the neatest first experiences I had. My experience with the silver cord, right, where basically I set up and I was sitting with my astral body, feeling my physical body very relaxed and very numb. I could hardly feel it, but I could definitely start to feel this astral body. And from the waist up, I could feel my astral body. And what was interesting to me is that it felt like there was something pushing my head as I stood up, set up. So I reached back, and that's when I felt it. I felt the silver cord very directly. And like I said, it felt organic, like biological, very real, dense, like branches coming into the back of my head, very neat. It was like I like to say, my matrix moment. But essentially, once you go far away from the body, many times you don't see it or feel it. And so it can be very biological-like when it's near the body. It can also be just very much like a field that you don't see or touch. You also hear about experiences of people kind of concealing it when they're out of the body. So it doesn't show that you are from the physical, right? You can kind of blend in. So that's an interesting thing about the silver cord. Of course, it's not silver necessarily, it's not a cord. It's really just a connection, an energy connection that keeps our body alive and vitalized. So really, technically, you don't go in the body, out of the body. It's just our perception of it, right? We are energetically connected to the body when we're born. When we go through death, that connection severs, right? And out-of-body experience is just like that energy becomes a little more elastic, if you will, and you can distance yourself, extend that connection for a while, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, typical, and come back. Could be longer, could be shorter. Let's see, we had some questions about remote viewing, and essentially my suggestion to distinguish the two is essentially, if you feel like you are in a body, you can pretty much bet it's an OBE because you are in a subtle body, away from the physical body. But if you feel like your eyes go somewhere, but your body is still back, you know, at home or wherever, then it's probably remote viewing, right? So that's the biggest difference. You could even draw what you see or write about what you see in remote viewing. The out-of-body experience, you're controlling another body, what the body, physical body, is asleep. So it's quite different in that sense. There was a question about whether we need to be conscious in to have an out-of-body experience, or to want to have an experience. And I guess it's a no to both, right? Because you can see people who go out of the body and essentially they're only partially awake or semi-awake, and they're not really aware. They're not that conscious out of the body. I've had one experience where I was just messing with some device or what I thought was like a radio or something. And then I questioned myself, why am I doing that? Where am I? So I actually created what's, I thought I created what's known as a lucid dream, where you realize that you're dreaming while the dream is still going on. So in that case, I was trying to determine, okay, am I having a lucid dream? Am I out of the body already? I wasn't sure. So I saw a couch and actually just lay down the couch and was able to float right back up. So I realized, oh, I'm already out. So I started looking around. I went through the wall and I was hovering above the terrain and kind of trying to recognize what it was. And I even saw someone at the house, but not that conscious, kind of like sleepwalking almost, but out of the body. And when I came back, I realized I was in my girlfriend's house at the time. So we went from my house to her house. And we were initially both unconscious. But then as far as will, then yes, they can also happen without you meaning to. In fact, most people, that's how they start. They were tired, they came home one night, they lay on the couch, and all of a sudden, they're looking back at the body and realize and thinking whether they're, what just happened? Or somebody that has sleep paralysis a lot and one day decides not to fight it and just goes with it and has an OBE. Well, like I said, someone could have a lucid dream and then question the dream and realize, oh, wait a second, how come I can talk in the water? And then realize, that's because this is a dream. And then they say, I don't want a dream. I want to go out of the body. And the imagery melts away, dissipates, and they realize they're actually already out of the body, but unconsciously, and all they'd have to do is move away from it. So you notice that lucid dreams tend to happen when you are partially out of the body already, free from the restriction of the physical body, or not completely free, but a little bit less so. So you tend to question your dreams more and so on. But obviously, if you are more conscious and you want to do it, you have better chances. And the frequency of the experience increases, or the gap between experiences decreases. And the kinds of things you do, obviously, get more interesting with time. Let's see, another question. Are your experiences always contemporaneous? When they do refer to the past, it's more of a recollection. It's not really like time travel where you can change things. But if you think about recall of past lives, if you are recalling that information, all those experiences didn't happen with this physical body, this brain. This is new to this life. You could have been, Iraqi person, so a completely different bloodline. There's nothing. It could have not come to you through genes. So that information is actually extra physical. You notice that if you look at the out-of-body experience, birth and death and rebirth, the one constant is the astral body, right? You have an astral body or emotional body. You get a new body every time. But that astral body is the same. So it actually retains that information. So sometimes you are able to tune in to that memory bank of your parabrain, if you will, your integral memory. And so you can sort of relive or at least see it almost like projected in front of you. So that would be an exception when it's not contemporaneous, where you're actually reliving something that happened between lives, in a previous physical life, or even while you're projected. Sometimes you go out of the body, you come back, you don't remember it, but then you go out again and you remember in that posterior experience. About the future also, like sometimes people go out of the body and they get a sort of premonition, right? So you get precognition, premonition, retrocognition, right, during the out-of-body experience. It's actually more likely to happen while you're out of the body because you are more, your channels are more wide open, right? Yeah, they're less filtered. There's less noise, right? Using terminology from our filters book. So indeed. So I'll give you an example. We had a student who was taking our courses and said that she had an out-of-body experience the night before the 2004 tsunami, and she felt like she was in a tropical beach, and she saw two large consecutive waves come on shore. So that's exactly what happened the next day, a few hours later. She almost felt, sometimes people even feel guilty, right? Oh, I saw the Challenger explosion, I saw the wreckage of the Twin Towers, and I could have done something. And really, that's that they couldn't have done anything, but they're simply tuning in to something that is resonating very strongly in the fabric of consciousness, right? Because it was there, these were impactful events to the whole world. But so certainly you can have precognitions or retrocognitions, right, in out-of-body experiences. Yeah. And Wagner Allegretti, he actually wrote a book on that topic as far as the past is concerned. He's the president of IEC currently, and he wrote a book on retrocognitions. If you're interested in that topic, I recommend it. It doesn't talk a lot about actual like accounts. When I was this, when I was a sailor in the past lives or whatever, or a soldier or something like that. It doesn't talk about that too much. It's really talking about out-of-body experience, how it connects to retrocognition, and then how you can apply all these things to your daily life. Because that's, I think, is an interesting question. Somebody asked last time, is what are the outcomes for someone who has several of these experiences or makes it part of their life or their existence? And we already touched on an important one, which is fear of death, the going away almost entirely, if not entirely. So while you are not welcoming it, looking forward to it right away, also you are not fearful of it because you know what happens later. You've previewed it so many times. Instead, you start asking about what is the point of being here? Well, how can I make the most out of it? And it usually ends up in two main things: improving yourself, your own attributes, your maturity, as helping others do the same and increase their awareness in your own. That pretty much sums it up. Of course, that can mean different things for different people, but this whole thing about receiving assistance and knowledge and sharing it is the key thing. That's why I love these webinars, because we are, you know, exchanging experiences, insights, and hopefully we can promote each other's growth as consciousness, right, and knowledge for ourselves and everyone who cares to join us for the ride, right? As something else, let's see, a question from Vasileos. Peter Fenwick provides a great deal of proof that near-death experiences are not explainable within the framework of today's neuroscience. What is the status with OBEs? Well, like we said, OBE is really a more general classification of NDEs, or NDEs are a particular kind of OBE. So he's absolutely right, right? Because if you're trying to explain something that the name says it all, out of body, you might as well call it out of brain, right? Experience. Brain's asleep. You as a consciousness, you're somewhere else. So you're not going to find what you're looking for in the brain if you are actually out. That is exactly right. But we don't have to look to OBEs. Neuroscience does not explain what is thought, where it comes from, what is intention, what is will, memory. So it does not explain many fundamental things because it's asking the wrong questions, looking in the wrong place. Well, perhaps it is partially looking in the right place, of course, but it's not the entire picture, right? So if you're asking, how does consciousness emerge from the brain? Well, it doesn't, so you're never going to find it. All right, so how does the brain, what has to happen in the brain to cause an OBE? Again, in certain circumstances, there could be triggers, physiological triggers, certain electromagnetic pulses or certain emotional states and so on. But that doesn't mean that just because you can trigger part of the brain and it causes an OBE, it doesn't make it not real. It just means that there can be physical triggers, emotional triggers, but really the ultimate trigger is willpower, you and will over your own system, mastery over your own consciousness, and that is not provided by the brain. You know, you don't. There could be correlates, but it's not the causation, right? And that's where people get confused. And even neuroscientists, they may know a lot about the brain, but they usually know squat about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. There was a six-month period when I was in my early 20s that I had good luck experiencing OBEs, says Scott Flagg. Since that time, despite attempts, I have had little success. What factors facilitate the vibratory state? Oh, very good question, Scott. Well, there are some techniques that have been developed, and there's been some interesting validation. So again, speaking about Wagner Allegretti, also his partner, Nancy Truvellato, they've done a study. Basically, they've been perfecting this technique to trigger the vibrational state. It's a simple technique, but for some reason, you know, actually executing it can be challenging for us, right? So some people have been doing it for a while and don't quite master it. So they started really looking into it, doing a lot of one-on-one training, and then to try to see, okay, when you reach a vibrational state, it's so intense, or it can be so intense, what is going on at the, you know, at the brain? Is there something that we could find? It was a very interesting question. So they actually lay down, they had a rest period, then they would apply this technique, which consists essentially of accumulating energy at one of the extremities, the head or the feet, and then moving it, coursing it through the entire body, just through your willpower, right? You're moving your attention, your intention, basically back and forth, creating some sort of rhythm and volume of energy that you can little by little increase and accelerate. And then eventually that back and forth circulation or oscillation can actually trigger the overall resonance known as vibrational state. So then obviously we were expecting something would happen then during the vibrational state. And essentially that didn't happen. Nothing too special worth writing home happened during the vibrational state. But after during the rest period, when they didn't expect much, they saw the activity at the brain essentially start to increase. So there's a color graph. So it went from, I think it was like yellow, then orange, red, purple, blue, until basically the entire brain is active. And weirdly, activity was showing up outside the brain. Now, that's not supposed to happen because the fMRI, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, uses some sort of pigment or something to be able to trace the activity, the oxygen level in the brain. So there's nothing going on outside the brain, but that vibratory state, the energy perhaps, was even having some weird electromagnetic effects. They were going to consult with a physicist to try and figure out what was happening. So that neuroscientist was very puzzled, let's put it that way. So it's really essentially a matter of practice, Scott, is the main thing. But there are other things as well. Obviously, if to have more OBEs, you'll notice that you do have some periods where you are more prone. But to sustain that, it's a little bit of a process, but it's really within your reach, anyone's reach. And it takes some consistent practice. You don't have to give up your, you know, your normal life, your normal existence. But it's like anything else. If you want to lose weight and you intend to go to the gym, okay, then you got to do it at regular intervals and so on. So the same thing. You want to learn any skill. But yeah, I would say that would be the thing that would facilitate the most. So the thing is that the vibrational state doesn't just help you have more out-of-body experiences. It will also help you health-wise, right? Because your energy is less stuck at particular spots. So those blockages less likely to somatize in time. Another interesting thing I'll just mention, it's not really tied to the OBE, but since we're talking about vibrational state, I'll just briefly mention that one of the things that we notice also is that when you trigger that state, it essentially decouples you, isolates you energetically from others, because we're constantly exchanging energy with others. That's something that is very easy to see from the out-of-body experience, but you can also basically learn to sense that. And sometimes that influence is not the best, right? Somebody who's not thinking very pleasantly about us or whatnot. So being able to decouple from that is very, very useful. And that's another benefit of vibrational state. Let's see. Does anyone have to express an explicit intention to go out of the body? Does it happen automatically? Essentially, either one could happen. Most of the times, people start out by having unintentional, unexpected experiences, right? They really were not trying, and they're left wondering what the heck just happened, right? So they can't happen like that automatically. But obviously, if you apply your will and your decision, motivation, and techniques, then you start having them more often. Is the difference between having one or two in your lifetime versus once a month, once a week, once a day? I mean, really, you can get to that level with enough practice, right? So we can be like your friend, Dr. Vieira, right, Brendan? So famous projectors that you hear about, they had a ton of experiences, but it wasn't always like that. They obviously have some sort of predisposition, but it comes with a process. Myself, I went from having basically one, and then I had to wait 2 years to have another, to then getting to the point where I was not having them daily, but certainly weekly, for sure. The other thing I want to mention, guys, if we do go through these stages in life where, you know, maybe we're more analytical or more creative in other stages, or, you know, we're very busy, or we have a little more time to ourselves to settle down. I mean, those conditions affect your predictability a lot, right? So right now I'm working a lot, running around, traveling too much. So my lucid experiences are lower, less frequent. I have more experiences that I just happen to be out and I remember that I was out, or I become conscious outside the body once I fell asleep, right? And then occasionally, then I will have an intentional one. Okay, I got kicked out there for a second. Maybe I lost my connection. But I was reading Scott's comment, and that's interesting too. Some specific periods of time where they're not ideal. You're under stress or an emotional duress, a difficult period in your life. I've heard of people who are in jail, you know, or some sort of condition like that, where the experience actually happens as a therapeutic thing, where it helps you get relief recover your dignity or liberty, or depends on the condition. But it can happen, you know, as part of your normal, healthy, ongoing life as well. But that's an interesting observation. Richard Mann, could there be two things going on, like manifesting the manifest and latent dream, suggesting that there is a latent knowing that manifests as does a dream through the word that is formed out of the silver cord, then would be part of the manifest concept? I'll be honest with you, I didn't quite follow that. I'm going to have to process that a little bit. Or maybe you can rephrase that for me, if you don't mind. If I understand a little bit of it, in a sense, the out-of-body experience, really the common one, is just one level. And there are more advanced levels of manifestation, right? So people talk about a causal dimension, a mental dimension, a world of ideas that goes beyond our normal concept of space and time, or as we've been calling here in the filters anthology, right, the source of reality. So certainly it's not the most advanced experience, but it's a stepping stone towards that. And we get closer to that world that is not manifest yet, right? Um, or 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 perhaps it is, right? If time is not as we see it, but certainly I would think that it would increase your chances of achieving those cosmic consciousness type experiences as you progress in these types of experiences. For one thing, it helps you realize your emotional maturity and further that. And so that itself will make you more prone. Also exposing you to new ideas, new dimensions, challenging your mind, broadening your universalism. All those things will make you more likely to have those advanced experiences eventually. So let's see. Well, that's very interesting. Zach said that all his OBEs are related to human architecture. Well, my wife will be very interested to talk to you about that. Right? She's studying architecture and has had OBEs and remote viewing very often. And she's deeply committed to that idea that, you know, we can bring any field that we have interest in, be it architecture, engineering, as we know from Bear, or whatever it is, history, and we can connect it to something bigger, something deeper, take it to a new level. So you talk about taking things to a new dimension, I mean, literally, right? So what kind of inspiration can we get with energies, with structures and cities that are not physical, but extra physical, right? In more subtle dimensions. That in itself is a whole study, and you could focus your OBEs just on that. What are those societies like? What is their culture like? What are their thoughts? How advanced is their knowledge? Are they talking about things that we will only discover here later because somebody finally tuned in to something that's already there? So think of the potential for new knowledge, new at least from our perspective here on the physical plane. That is very compelling to me, right? Certainly. Very interesting. Let's see. Interesting, yeah. So, yeah, we could use physical landmarks certainly to as a meeting point of sorts. Why not? Yeah, I've heard of people using things like volcanoes as just an interesting target. I think of what it would be like to go to like an aquarium where you have dolphins and, you know, these very intelligent mammals. Would they be able to see you, to recognize you? We had a member of a pair, ICRL, who once shared with me an experience being out on a boat and seeing these dolphins out of the body. And the dolphins were able to see her and they recognized that she was there, and they were exchanging some sort of sentiment. It was very neat. So even animals, you know, can see us when they're out of the body many times, and they can also go out of the body, especially people talk about meeting their pets out of the body, or once they pass away, just like humans, they come back many times and visit and say hi. And of course, it'll be easier to interact with them if we go to their level, to their dimension, right? Temporarily. So the idea we can meet relatives and other dear beings, pre-human or human, is also a very nice benefit of the experience. Okay, so I guess we're out of time. I would be willing to answer any other questions, but if you guys have to run, especially our friends out in the old continent in Europe, thanks for tuning in, and it's very nice interacting with you. And hope to see you in the body or out of the body, you know, soon. Thanks everyone for tuning in and participating. And I'm looking forward to the next webinar. We'll be in touch. So long.